And I think that's where a lot of designers or just people who have jobs are scared to say it. They're scared to say like, hey, I can't meet at 11 tomorrow because they have dads with donuts at school. I'm not missing a dads with donuts for anything, Antonio. Nothing. I've been to 3 this year. I'm not missing them. I know, again, I get it. It does sound cliche, but it is being deliberate with what is important to you.
Welcome to the Dadwell Podcast. I'm your host, Antonio Garcia. Dadwell & Company is an independent media project at the intersection of creativity and fatherhood. The Dadwell Podcast features makers, artists, musicians, authors, filmmakers, and designers who are raising the creative bar while simultaneously raising small humans. Today I'm talking creativity and fatherhood with Chief Creative Officer Jared Reeder. Jared and I met in the Advertising Design School at the Atlanta College of Art almost 25 years ago. Today he runs Question Mark to Period, a marketing and design agency in Atlanta. He's a larger-than-life personality, a globe-trotting storyteller, a Taekwondo black belt, and a Sunday school teacher. He's released 5 independent hip-hop albums, founded a creative collective of renowned black curators a decade before influencers took over social media, and launched a wildly successful luxury bag company. He also got me to run my very first marathon. Jared is dad to his 8-year-old daughter and 4.5-year-old son. In this episode, Jared talks about his father's military discipline, attention to detail, and struggles with alcohol, a primary reason why he himself doesn't drink. We talk about how he attended the prestigious Pratt Institute at age 6, and how this exposure, and growing up with siblings a decade older than him, shaped his gregarious, competitive personality. He explains why the world needs fewer rappers and professional athletes, and shares the secret word his mother used to push his critical thinking.
So tell me about your own origin story, your own upbringing, your dad or other father figures that you had in your life as a young person.
Yeah, so my father was a truck driver and a professional bowler, right? So that combination already starts off like, what the hell? He also served in Vietnam. I have an older brother, older sister. My brother is 11 years older than me. My sister's 10 years older than me. And so they said that I was like kind of the accident child. And so growing up as the youngest, I guess you could say I was a spoiled one. My mom and dad were kind of just tired by the time I came into the world, right? And so my dad, you know, heavy drinker, big time drinker. And my parents were divorced when I was in the 4th grade. And so it was a lot of turmoil in the household. My brother and sister were leaving to go to college. I was there. My dad was still, you know, recovering from Vietnam. There was just a lot of fights and just anger and issues and just things that went on. And so I like to always try to put a positive spin on things, right? My dad was a wonderful dad. He showed up at all my sporting events. He was always there to buy me the new Jordans that came out. But when I look back, I think a dad is not always just about how you treat your kids. It's also about how you treat your wife or your significant other. It is how you act throughout society, whether it be going to church and the barbershop and things of that nature. As a father, man, the way that you think, the way that you position yourself, the way people even see you. And so I had a positive role model in my dad, but there are also some negative, really negative aspects. You know, with the positives, I learned to always be on time. You know, that's the military for my dad, to care about how you look, right? The meticulous details. And I think that transcends into design even, right? And that definitely came from my dad. And then as far as taking the negative aspects, my dad used a lot of anger. So there was a lot of spankings, whoopings, whatever you want to call it. So with my kids, I try, keyword is try, to channel that anger, that discipline. And then also, you know, my dad was a heavy drinker. So on one hand, he was a really funny guy. But when he would drink, I could always see how he would change. So I don't drink. I also had other father figures or other role models that were men in my life. I have a black belt in Taekwondo. And so my sensei, Master Huggins, was really instrumental in my upbringing, teaching me a lot about discipline and about self-control. There was my grandfather, who I lived with after my parents got a divorce, who was, you know, tremendous. He was in the church. He applied God to everything, right? You know, sporting events to watching the Golden Girls. I mean, it was like, you know, Christianity was a part of everything. And I look at my life now and I teach Sunday school. I try to attend church regularly. So, yeah, I mean, I think being a father has many aspects to it. I think most people think it is just rearing the child, getting them up, making sure they brush their teeth and things of that nature. But I think something that people miss out on is what do you do every day that your kids see? You know, when I was a big time runner, my kids were running. They wanted to run. They wanted to go on runs with me. They wanted running shoes. And you saw that, right? Right now, I'm in this big mode of kind of reading books and getting physical books and reading. And you start to see that they want books and go to the library. And I think that's part of being a dad, being a father figure is kind of cleaning up your act, right? And making sure that everything you do is something that you want your kids to do.
Yeah, I think the thing you're describing, they're sort of telling your kid what to do. Hey, get up. Hey, brush your teeth. Hey, you know, the kind of constant ordering around,
right,
that's required to get your kid through the day. But then there's the modeling of behavior, you know, just how you carry yourself, the things that you do, like you said, not just at home, but out in the world and in society. And that's a bit of the do as I do side of it.
Absolutely.
Without having to say to your kids, hey, let's go to the library. Let's check out a bunch of books. Let's explore topics and subjects you're interested. You just demonstrate that.
That's it.
By having books around and spending time and them seeing dad reading books. And that exposure, visibility, is sometimes enough for them to go, I want books too.
Yeah.
And I'm going to collect books like dad.
It becomes a cycle, right? Because if you look at the things that you are into right now, chances are you had to see it first, right? Whether it's your parents, whether it's an athlete, someone, you had to see it, right? I see my kids now. I have a 4-year-old, Miles, 7-year-old, Elle. And I see it mostly in my daughter. She makes all A's, but we've been to the school maybe 4 or 5 times already this year for her being disruptive, right? And when I tell you, this is exactly me, right? I remember sitting in teacher-parent conferences with my mom, and I'll never forget my 5th grade teacher, Miss Ailawan, said, Mrs. Reeder, he is without a doubt the smartest kid in the 5th grade. Like, she goes, I'm telling you, it's almost like he's a grown-up. Because some of his conversations are so advanced. And she goes, I don't know if he's around a lot of kids at home or a lot of adults, but if possible, we need to get him around more kids. I remember my teacher's names, right? Because I was always hanging out with my brother and my sister, who were 10 and 11 years old, and their friends. So the conversation was just a little different, right? Of course. Mm-hmm. But I look at Elle and it's the same thing. And then my mother sends me a quote. It said, one of the hardest pills to swallow is being a biological parent trying to discipline the you out of your child. Right? Because, like, put this in perspective. On a Friday, she got a report card. She got 16 A's. I think 6 of them were A pluses, right? And then there are notes beside every grade. Immediately, I go straight to the art, right? Elle is one of the top art students in the school. She's amazing. She always tells us about how her father's an artist. And I'm just looking forward to see her blossom more. And, I'm excited. And then I look at the next one, and it's science. And it's like, Elle has trouble controlling herself. Elle is talking excessively. These are all the exact same things. And I can't even get mad because I'm just like, you know, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, right? So it goes back to say, like, you want your kids to brush your teeth every day and to honor a schedule and be consistent, you have to be that first. I have a very aggressive personality at times, a big personality, I'll say. And so when I'm around a big crowd, typically, you know, I'm cracking jokes and kind of, and I know that my kids see that. I'm starting to see those same traits in them. And I don't know that it's always positive.
Sure. Oh, when you get the comments back on that report card. But at the same time,
Elle could be the next Eddie Murphy. And we're telling her, no, you need to be quiet. You need to sit still, right? That's not what an artist does. We are the vocal ones. But as a parent, it's still our duty to provide that structure and that understanding and the feedback. Like, hey, you got all A's and we're supposed to go off ice cream, but we're not. Because even though you got A's, many of your teachers says you are the most disruptive student in the class.
Yeah.
You need to understand what that means.
And I wonder if the positioning there is, this appears to come naturally to you, Elle. Obviously, you're getting straight A's. And your disruption may be keeping other people from getting straight A's because it's distracting them. And maybe they can't concentrate the same way that you can, or it doesn't come as naturally and they've got to work harder. And if you're talking and distracting, then, you know, they can't do what you do. You know, have her set the tone for how to be, which should align well with like how she thinks of herself as a leader. Here's a chance to demonstrate, you know, the right way to be in class.
Right. Right.
You mentioned having hobbies like running and your kids mirroring that behavior and wanting running shoes and wanting to get out there and run with you. Did your dad have hobbies? You mentioned he bowled, but did his occupation or his hobbies in any way influence your creative pursuits?
It was my mother. Mm. So my mother is an artist. And then my brother went to art school. My sister went to art school. With my dad, it was kind of the opposite, right? He was more of the Joe Jackson figure. So he was a professional bowler. You know, he's bowling 300s. He's traveling to Las Vegas for bowling tournaments. He comes back and there was a little bit of me that was like, oh, I want to bowl. And he was like, oh, you do? Perfect. And then next thing I know, I'm in a bowling league that meets at 8 a.m. on Saturdays. So here I am wanting to watch the damn Smurfs and He-Man and the Roadrunner. And I'm waking up at 7 o'clock, really 6 o'clock, because he wants me to eat a certain breakfast to be ready. And I mean, it was just, it was excessive, man. It was Joe Jackson. Like, hey, get those steps right. I mean, I had my own ball. It was drilled. I had bags and gloves and chalk. You know, at that age, it was like, shit, man, I just want to throw the ball down the lane and learn how to make it spin. You know, can you teach me how to throw a hook? And it just became so excessive that after the first year, I was like, I don't want to bowl anymore. I'm done.
But seeing your siblings and your mother, there's creativity in the house, obviously.
Absolutely.
How did that lead to you going to the Atlanta College of Art?
So my sister's 10 years older than me. And she skipped a grade. So she started college around the same time that I started the first grade. And so my mom was terrified of sending her only daughter to Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, New York, Pratt Institute, you know, middle of the hood at 16. And so it makes no sense now looking back, but her way to deal with this was anytime that I had a break from school, she would send me to New York to be around my sister, to hang with her, just be with her. And so, of course, my sister's taking me to class with her. So here you have this 6-year-old, 7-year-old, 8-year-old, 9-year-old, all 4 years that she's there. And I know her professors. And the professors are saying things like, oh, if you're going to sit in this class, then you're going to participate. So now I'm doing drawings and nude figures. But also, I remember the encouragement. I remember people saying like, damn, he's 7? Like, he's actually really good. It fueled it, man. All I wanted to do was draw. And so I started drawing sneakers. You know, so I would have the David Robinsons, the Jordans, the Scottie Pippins or whatever. And I would just draw them. And then I would draw them so much that I would start to, like, create new shoes, right? So I would take the midsole from the David Robinson and put the Jordan straps. And then I would just add, like, new and then write, like, a paragraph. And my mom saw it. I was like, oh my goodness, this is like an ad. And so she started entering my drawings into the local newspaper. So every Sunday, they would highlight a winner for like the first 3 weeks. We would get the Sunday paper, we would open it up. My drawing wasn't there. And so my mom took me to the newspaper. She goes, you know, we've been sending my son's drawings in. And they were like, oh yeah, Jared Reeder. It's like, unfortunately, there's no way an 8-year-old is drawing those. And she was like, oh, really? Okay, cool. So I'll never forget this. True story. We go to Eckerd's drugstore. My mom buys like this drawing pad. She gives me a bunch of pencils. she takes me back up there and she sits me down and she gives me a Sports Illustrated. She's like, you know, draw whatever you want out of here. Flip through it and here's a picture of Jordan dunking on Stacey Aukman. And I start drawing it. And my mom leaves, like goes back to work. And I'm sitting there drawing, right? And I draw it and I use my finger to shade in, just like I learned at Pratt, you know? When I started drawing, there was one guy. And then I look up and now it's like 7-8 people behind me. And they're all looking and they're like, man, you are so talented. Man, I'll never forget that feeling of cheesing. Like Kanye West, how he gets when he just cheeses about anything. I just had this big Kool-Aid smile like, yeah, thanks. Thanks, guys. And I went on to win the next 6 weeks. And they finally called my mom and told her, you know, he won the last 6 weeks. Let's give someone else a chance. So let's not submit anymore. So that was kind of my entry into like, hey, you're an artist.
I love it, man. That's a great story. So you knew from exposure this early, like you said, like I learned at Pratt. Yeah, you know, like. Yeah,
and then it went to another level because, you know, after that, as I started high school, my sister had Photoshop and Quark Express, Corel Draw. And as she was learning it, she was teaching it to me. So, you know, I remember getting to Atlanta College of Art and like getting into an advertising class. I was like, yo, I'm ready to bang this out. Like, who's my competition, you know?
So we meet in design school and study advertising design. And I know right out of school, you worked in a number of agency capacities and different sorts of firms before striking out on your own. And I want to get to that too. But at the same time that you were doing 9-to-5 design work, you were recording music and assembling a group of subject matter experts to do creative things outside of the construct of normal agency client work. Can you tell me about both of those projects?
Definitely. I said this when I was 21, and I'm now saying it at 39. I think the world needs less rappers. And I truly believe that. When I hear people say, oh, yeah, I'm a rapper. You know, I got a mixtape. I'm working on something, blah, blah, blah. It does something to me. It does. Because I just think the world needs less. I think we need less basketball players. As football players, it's just a feeling, right? But I enjoy rapping. I enjoy writing. I enjoy seeing something and then creating an experience that tells that same story, regardless of the medium. And so for me, it started out my best friend at the time, Kenton Dixon. I thought he was the best rapper that I had ever heard. He had the voice, his lyrics, I mean, his cadence, everything was there. It reminds you a lot of J. Cole now. I tell him that all the time. His problem is he just never had beats. He never had a studio to record. He never had money to record. It was just all, you know, and he's like, yo, I don't have an album cover. Like, I don't have photography. And it started out with me just trying to provide for him.
Like executive produce for him?
Everything. I was making beats. I was building a studio that he could record in. I was buying mics, studying sound engineer books. I was designing this album cover. I was taking photography. I mean, and doing it, right? And then every now and again, he's like, you know what? Why don't you get a verse on it? It's like, yeah, you're right. Let me write something. And I would write it. And then over time, I was like, you know what? I'm going to work on my own project. Because every time I would write a verse and be on a song with him, I just felt like he out-rapped me. He outshined me. And I was just like, you know what? We should probably take my verse off. Like, my voice just sounds very puny compared to yours. And so,
I mean, he's got a deep, commanding voice.
Like, it's so commanding.
It's a great voice.
Yeah, it's great, you know? And so, you know, I started working on my own. And something happened when I started working on my own. I realized that I had things that I wanted to say. I had a perspective that was unique. I never sold drugs. I don't smoke weed. I'm not in the hardcore genre, but I'm not like that backpack rapper either, right? Mm-hmm. It was just like, I am who I am. It was like when I first heard Outkast, it was unique because it was a perspective that I identify with. I'm from South Carolina. We don't have any celebrities in South Carolina. There's never been anybody. I mean, not even, you know, political sports figures. I mean, we had Jesse Jackson, but he claimed Chicago, right? So it was one of those things where I was like, okay, I don't even want to be famous, but I want to make music and I want to go back and I want to give it to the people from my neighborhood. And I want them to be able to chant Nickeltown, South Carolina. And I made an album. And I made an album about dealing with my father's alcohol issues. I made songs talking about divorce, to talking about getting kicked out of public school and then going to private school and then coming back to public school, what it felt like. And I had fun doing it. It was a creative outlet, right? So it's one thing to work in a cubicle, like you said, for 8-9 hours. You get off and you have something to look forward to. And made the album. I think I printed like maybe 200 copies. I went home. I gave them out. I didn't sell it, nothing. Just gave them out. And exactly what I thought would happen, happened. I would go home to visit my mom and I would hear my song playing at a red light. And I would look over and I wouldn't even know the person who was playing it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it was like, whoa, this is crazy. And this person would look over and see me and not even know that they're listening to me. You know what I mean? Because I never put my picture on any of the album covers. It was intentional. And then from there, it started to build. People were like, yo, when is the next one coming out? On the first album, there were a few songs where my best friend Desert was on. And those were the songs that people were responding to. So I was like, yo, we should put out a group album. You know what I mean? Let's have fun with this. Mm-hmm. You're like, it's not costing us anything. And so that's what we did. And it was just fun. It was a creative outlet. I mean, we ended up recording 5 albums. And to this day, I go home and people are like, yo, what's up with Left Field Presents, man? Can we just get one song? And I'm like, no, I have 2 kids and I'm about to turn 40. No, not at all. Like, no, I don't really have anything to say. Right? I've addressed everything I wanted to address. Our last album was The World Is Yours. On that album, I talked a lot about being a dad, having a kid. And so I transitioned from making music into a creative collective that was called SME, which stood for Subject Matter Experts. And that idea really came from Queer Eye with Straight Guy. It talked about all the facets of being a true gentleman. And for me, it represented just being better all around. Queer Eye for the Straight Guy was like about that. It was like, you need to better yourself. You should be learning a second language. Make sure your hair is trimmed. These are the best fabrics that are for you. Here's how you hold a fork. And so when I looked at that, I was like, the people who should be watching that show would never watch that show. Right? It's like religion. You know, When a preacher gets up and he's preaching, 99% of the things that are coming out of his mouth, the people in the congregation, they've heard it. It should be the people who are not at church that need it. And so I wanted to create an African-American version of this, but even make it broader. So we had a music expert. I served as the aesthetic expert, right? So it's anything that's visual, everything from design to fashion to cars. We also had a travel expert, film expert. I mean, we ran a gamut of it. 2 of us who were subject matter experts, we were having a conversation one day and I was just like, look, man, when I travel, the bags that I like are typically $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, you know, from Louis Vuitton bags, things of that nature. And I was like, I can't afford that. But then the cheaper bags are like the Tumi bags and they're so plain and ugly. So I was like, we should create something, man. And so we created a bag called the J. Gray bag. And it was based off of a 1920s doctor's bag. It was great. You know, the biggest thing that probably hurt us is we came out of the gate too fast. We had a person in San Francisco who was making them by hand. And she could make one every 2 days. And we started with about 100 bags. And Future wore one of our bags in his video. And we were pretty much sold out of the bags. And there were back orders and pre-orders. And so we had to give a lot of money back and we lost a lot of money. And
because you couldn't scale it.
We couldn't scale it. We even tried to go to China and go that route of like, hey, we'll mass produce it, blah, blah, blah. The quality was so bad and it just went against everything that the brand stood for. You know, it was handmade,
right?
US made. Yeah, it just did not work together.
That's wild. I didn't know that was the thing that set off the exposure.
Yeah, Future, Anthony Hamilton, Rich Homie Quan, Nas, and Jidenna. And Questlove. Questlove actually wore it while performing on tour.
Looking back, Subject Matter Experts was ahead of its time in terms of
the
concept. You know, like social media hadn't really picked up in the way that it is now,
right?
Where, you know, people are seeking the perspectives and points of view of of influencers and where you can create content for a living, your product could be your perspective. And so here was this, this assembly of Black men with a perspective on a handful of things that I think right now in terms of kind of popular culture and social media culture, like matter a lot, you know, like aesthetics and travel and music and film. And, you know, like these are the things that you know, if you want to be interesting, you should have a point of view on these things, right?
For us, it was about finding a niche, right? We're Black. We're in Atlanta. And these just happen to be people that I already knew. So it just made sense. And like you said, this is before a lot of social media hit, but when I would go back and I would check the numbers, I was like, there's no way these numbers are correct. Like, what? And it would show like, yeah, this week you guys had 42,000 visitors. And it's like, wait, what? 42,000 visitors and we put up 6 quick short stories, right?
Yeah.
And now you fast forward 2019, I can show you 10 groups who are nothing but subject matter experts, like just renamed and repackaged.
Right.
And they should be, because it's time for it, right? And they're doing it. And what they're doing better is they're creating items based on their conglomerate. So
it was all just a little too soon, I think.
I always say that, but even with what we did, we had an expose on CNN. We had a partnership with the Big Brothers Big Sister. We had, I mean, you know, like the list goes on. Like, and we would go to events and people would see us and like, can I take a picture with you guys? And we're like, what? Like, they're like, yeah, I follow your blog. I'm on it all the time. I'm like, all right, cool. But I think what happened, like many things, everyone had full-time jobs. People had kids. Over time, it just kind of fizzled out, right?
You mentioned that at a point in that collective, you know, people were married, people have kids, not everybody could participate in the same way. And you also mentioned when it came to making music, 5-6 albums in, you'd said everything you wanted to say, and now you were touching on topics and subject matter specific to being a new dad. And right. So both of these projects in ways butt up against the fact that you're a different person than when you started them, right? Now you
absolutely
are married and a father. And so I'm curious, when did that shift happen for you? The kind of collision of these creative pursuits and then finding out the fact that you're going to be a dad. How did those two things collide?
There was no collision at all. Subject matter experts actually started when Elle was born. Our first group photo shoot, like Elle was on set. For me, it was really important for her to see that, to see her dad amongst other men. I always tell people, like, there's your family, there's your work, and then there's always going to be a third thing that's going to consume your time. And so my thing is always to be deliberate with that time. During the subject matter expert time, you know, I was spending a lot of time about aesthetics. And what it made me realize was, like, aesthetics also represented health. At that point, when I had a child, I hit that awareness where I was like, okay, I'm not just living for me anymore. I gotta be healthy. And so I started running and I hired a running coach. I was running with running groups. I started working at a running store. I was in talks with Nike about deals. I mean, you name it. Like I was really into it. And that's where the transition happened. With that transition, it was a great transition because it allowed my kids to see exercise, fitness, taking care of yourself. It's important. And even from that transition to now, the transition is kind of transition to travel, right? And so I did not grow up traveling. But at the same time, it was always a burden to me, right? So I went to a high school that was 50-50 right down the middle. You had rich white kids, you had poor Black kids. I mean, if I could go back and take a picture of the lunchroom, you wouldn't even believe it. You would think it was 1950s. And it wasn't that anybody hated each other. It was just the makeup of the school and how the lines were drawn throughout the city. And in the midst of that, I remember, you know, being on a basketball team and, you know, you're talking to your white friends and teammates, and they're like, hey, what are you doing for a spring break? Where are you guys going? I'm like, going to my grandfather's house, like up the street. That was, what are you talking about? Where are you going? Oh, we're going to Switzerland to ski. And looking back then, it didn't register. But I look back and it pissed me off. Because subconsciously, I wanted to be going somewhere. I wanted to, know what it was like to, I was, I took French 4 years in high school. But it never dawned on me to, hey, go to Paris, go to France. Try to figure out how to get there. Because it just was never presented. So when I got married to Nina, the night before we got married, we made a list of 25 places that we wanted to visit before we died. It was our bucket list, so to speak. And we vowed to be aggressive in getting this list done. Well, we were blessed because within 3 years, we had knocked off 18 out of 25. And we were okay, we got this list because we're a little bit more aggressive than we thought. But I say all that to say,
this is before you had kids that you got all that travel in?
A little bit of both. So we probably hit 10 to 12 before. And then, when we had L, we hit a lot of the other ones. But what was interesting is the first trip that we took was to Paris and London. When we got there, the time change was crazy. And Nina just slept for the first 15 hours. I could not sleep because I was so excited and I couldn't believe that I was in London. And I just went for a run. And I think it's midnight their time. And I'm just running through the city and I'm passing all these landmarks. And I couldn't believe it. Immediately, it did something to me. It inspired me. It is something that you understand, man, within the United States, we're so insulated. Mm-hmm. It's always so much about us, right? And I remember I got lost. I was like, oh shit, I don't remember how to get back to my hotel. I was like, oh my God. It was to the point, I don't remember the name of my hotel. Right? This is my first time out of the country. Luckily, I'm in a country that, they speak English. I was like, all right, I remember there's a TGI Fridays.
Right? Of course.
I know, right? How ridiculous is that? And I'm asking people, hey, where's the TGI Fridays around here? And they're like, son, it's closed. It's 1 a.m. I was like, I know, but I need it for a landmark. Long story short, I made it back. Something happened that night, man. It fueled me. I was so blown away by this feeling and this emotion. My energy, when you say I think it just transforms. Your energy it never dies. It just continues in a new form. When you talk about this being
like creative energies, you're saying?
Yeah, just creative energy. I think once you can articulate it or once you can just even understand it, for me, it put me at ease. Because there were times where I was like, damn, I have not painted in 2 years or I haven't drawn something in a year. What the hell is going on? But then you look back and you're like, I've curated a trip. I've taken four people who have never, ever been on an airplane. And I made sure they got their passport. And they now travel every year with us on our group trip. And now they bring their parents who had never traveled outside of the country, right? Mm-hmm. And then you start to see, without being self-centered, but you say, I'm responsible for an entire family to witness another person's culture because we introduced them to it. And I think some people say, well, that's not really creative, but it is. A lot of times, the reason people want to travel with us and go on our trips is because of a video that I put together every year, because of imagery that I create. That is creative energy. The new energy that I'm putting out now is just for lack of better terms, is trying to get people to take ownership of what they're doing with their hours, because there's a lot of hours.
You have a high output,
right?
You're productive. You're involved in, running your own agency at this point, and you've got these side hustles, and you're somewhere in a series of 5 or 6 albums deep, and there's just a lot going on, and then you find out that you're expecting.
Right.
Can you recall your thoughts, emotions with regards to, here's all the things that I've got running now, and I'm about to add to the mix a baby?
No, because I never, ever looked at it from that perspective. I never looked at it as I'm adding a baby to all the things that I'm doing, right? For me, it was like, okay, this business that I'm running, I need her to see this business. I need her to see daddy running. I want her to see daddy traveling. I want her to travel with us because a baby is not an addition, right? It's a part of it. So it's not like it's extra. You see a lot of new parents that are scared to take their baby out in public. Oh, I don't want to offend people. I don't want it to cry. Oh, I don't want to take it to a restaurant. We were the opposite. I think this story will put it in perspective. Miles started preschool and they were learning about their address and learning where they live so that they could alert authorities if something would happen. And as they're going through it, they go through and they ask Miles, so Miles, where do you live? And he said, Mexico. And they start laughing and they're like, yo, what are you talking about? I live in Mexico. That's where we have the most fun. Mexico. I go to pick Miles up and the teacher pulls him to the side. And she goes, has Miles ever even been to Mexico? And I was like, yeah, 5 times. And she's like, excuse me? So yeah, we travel a lot. And so we've been to Cancun and I start naming Puerto Vallarta. I start naming all these places. She's like, oh. Well, the reason I ask because she tells me the story. And then she's like, so wait, Miles has been... So he has a passport? I was like, yeah, of course he does. Like, you know, that was our mentality. They don't know anything outside of traveling, outside of being busy. Like I know this sounds ridiculous because I remember when I would hear people say it, I was like, oh, shut up. But I think people have more free time than they realize.
Hmm.
And I mean that. Like, I mean, I was in a workshop and it said the average person spends 6.5 to 7 hours a day on social media. And I was like, no way. I was like, I'm not on a damn social media that much. Are you crazy? And I went in and sure enough, 6 hours and 42 minutes on average. And I was like, oh my God. So I went in and I set my limit to 2 hours a day. And that was it, 2 hours. So I specifically will pick like one of the early hours. The kids are still asleep or whatever. And then I'll spend another hour like later on in the evening. It puts in the order so that you're not just anytime there's dead time at a stoplight, you tap Instagram and just kind of scroll through, right? To the average person that hears that, it's like, man, that makes sense, but it's so hard because we're just so accustomed to, all right, I don't have anything to do. My attention span is here. Let me turn it on, right?
Yeah.
So that's what's helped me, right? When you talk about like, well, how did you approach this when you had a new kid? And again, there were some hurdles. Of course, I'm not Superman. I mean, there were times where my wife was like, listen, you cannot go out for a 4-hour run right now. I need you to change this diaper and allow me to take a nap. Cool. You make adjustments. But I just don't buy that notion of like, we're having a baby. I need to stop playing golf or I can't enjoy basketball anymore. Like you, by doing that, it's only going to make you bitter. You're going to gain weight. And then that's going to lead to even more problems. And then your kids are not going to see you living a true, joyful life.
Yeah. It sounds like a lot changed and a lot stayed the same. Like you didn't give up on these things. You just fit them into new time slots or you reprioritize them, but you didn't abandon them. And you're also running a studio and you described yourself as being, you know, incredibly hands-on and wanting to lead all the things and, you know, touch all facets of the business. And so did you keep that attachment to the work running during all of this or was there a change there?
I was hands on. I cut back on sleep. If I'm going to really be honest, I don't need 7-8 hours of sleep. I can function on 5. I can get an extra 3 hours of working, right? You're a runner, so you understand this. As a runner, you're out running for 3, 4, 5 hours at a time. You start to learn how to play a lot of mental games with yourself and tricking yourself, you know, making yourself feel better than you really are to get through it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's the most extreme thing that could happen? So like you say, like, okay, you lose your job or you quit your job for a year and you want to do something. What's the worst thing that could happen? The worst thing? I could go homeless. Nah, you wouldn't go homeless. You have enough friends and family and support that you know that wouldn't happen. But when you can identify what's the worst thing that can happen and you realize it's not even that bad, in my opinion, it makes everything better. So that's how I look at it. It's like, okay, I can cut down on sleep, but I just need to knock this out because I want to get it done. And that's where I told you, like, when I started the agency, the worst thing that could happen is that it fails and I would go right back to getting a job. Well, when you think about that, it's like, okay, I'm working a job. So you're telling me the worst thing that could happen is that I would be right back here? Well, shit, let me go start an agency. Right? It just makes sense.
Yeah. Do your children play a role in any of your creative endeavors?
Absolutely. I try to do exactly what my sister did with me, with Elle. So as I'm working on a logo or a website, like, Elle, talk to me about colors. How do you feel about these colors? And I'll ask her, you know, a series of questions. Or we'll go through fonts where she just presses the down button. And she says, I like this font. And I was like, well, why do you like that font? And you never really know when you're teaching a lesson how people are receiving it. You know, they can shake their head and be like, oh, this is great, man. You killed it, right? And then they go about their business and they forget all about it. I knew that it was getting to Elle because Elle came to me for her last birthday party. And I said, Elle, what do you want to do for your birthday party? She says, I want to have a sleepover and I want to invite 5 friends. So immediately I'm like, I don't know about that. But then she went to a whole nother level. She goes, well, you know, I like pears and I want to transform our house into pears. I was like, oh. And she was like, I think the living room could be the Eiffel Tower. You can create it to where, like, we're going up in the Eiffel Tower. And I think the garage could be the Louvre. And then that's where we can have our paint party. We can sit out there and paint. And I was like, oh my God, this is great, right? This is where it hit me. This is where I teared up a little bit. Her name is Elle, E-L-L-E. At the time when she was conceived, Nina and I, we were in Paris. We loved Paris. And so we named her Elle, right? It means she in French. And so she's always been fascinated, of course, with Elle magazine. This is her name. She said for a party, she wanted to do her own Elle magazine. I was like, oh, it's genius. And for the pages, she wanted to do spreads of all the girls who were coming over to the party. So that when they got there and as they flipped open, they had their own spread. And we designed it together. And it was probably top 3 highlights of my life, honestly, because it was marrying my love for publication design, for graphic design, color theory, typography, my love for my daughter, of course. You know, my wife is a writer. So then my wife sat with her to write the stories for all of her friends. And it just came out beautifully, man. So much that, you know, we had people, you know, saying, hey, how much did you charge to do this for my kids? And I was like, yeah. You know,
I love it. There's a level of intention or intentionality about all the things, you know, like you said, how you spend time and your daughter scrolling through a list of typefaces and says, I like this one. And that's not enough. You know, you ask, well, how come, you know, what about this typeface? Do you like, how'd you get to be like that? Like, where does this level of intentionality come from and kind of specificity about your reasons for doing things or the rationale behind the things that you do?
You know, I think it's from my upbringing. My mother, you know, she's a motivational speaker. We used to always have this inside joke and it was just a single word. It was stretch. Stretch. If you ask, like, you know, mom, is there any way I can borrow $25? For what? I want to get this Tim Hardaway t-shirt. She would be like, stretch. What that meant was figure out how to come to her to ask for the $25 where I could earn it. Or it meant figure out how to get the $25. You know what I mean? Like, go cut some grass. You know what I mean? But what it really meant was it was critical thinking. You know, I can't thank her enough because I do it still. Sometimes too much, right? My wife sometimes says, like, can you just relax your mind for a second and just enjoy this, right? I see people all the time with something great, something special, and they just don't have the tenacity to get to the finish line, man. You know, it's hard. When you say, like, where did I get it? I really think for my mom, I think growing up, seeing it, you know what I mean? Like, she's a critical thinker.
Yeah, I like the one word prompt to stretch your thinking, to be a little more creative with how you go about it, to come to her with more rationale or evidence for why you need that $25, or double back to the drawing board and figure out, you know, how do I get $25 without asking my mom for it? That's a great little prompt or provocation for you to try a little harder.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can appreciate the Gary Vee school of thought or just the idea that you have to look at your calendar and look at your schedule and be really intentional about how you're spending time and cut out anything that is a distraction. Like you said, like reducing your time on social media and, you know, cutting away the tasks and activities, you know, anything that's sort of standing in the way of getting these things done. And I think in theory, that makes sense. Like, yes, right. we could all probably use our time more effectively or, you know, skip binge watching a couple of shows in favor of getting done what we know needs to get done. But then I think maybe I'm just personally hung up on this. But
when Miles was born, I had 41 clients and I made sure that every one of my clients knew that I just had a kid and that that kid was the most important thing in my life. And for the clients that didn't, they weren't my clients anymore, or they didn't need to be my clients, right? And I think that's where a lot of designers or just people who have jobs are scared to say it. They're scared to say like, hey, I can't meet at 11 tomorrow because they have dads with donuts at school. I'm not missing a dads with donuts for anything, Antonio. Nothing. I've been to 3 this year. I'm not missing them. I know, again, I get it. It does sound cliche. But it is being deliberate with what is important to you, what you're going to get done today. I want to do a podcast, water flush, call my mom, love my kids. I need to go to the ATM to get money to pay for the sitter. I'm going to watch the national championship game tonight. I'm going to put the kids to bed and shower. I'm going to eat dinner. I'm going to make sure I pray on my knees. Like, that's on my list. I'm going to do that, right? And now you may say, well, what happens if your daughter gets sick? Or what happens if this? Okay, you adjust, right? Like anything. Whatever you need to do in the moment, you do it in the moment. Also, I mean, your creative inspiration should never suffer because of your surroundings. It shouldn't. And again, like just how you're saying, I just feel the opposite. I'm just like, what is the problem? Like it's, and I'm telling you what it is. A lot of times we're telling ourselves that. The conversations that I have with myself every day. Oh man, if you had a transcript for that, I would be in a psych ward right now, padded walls, everything. But I know myself and I know what it takes for me to be effective. You know, I'm not joking. I've had some of my designers say, like, Jared, can we ask you a serious question? I'm like, what's up? Do you use cocaine? That's like, oh my God. I laugh. I'm like, no, I don't. I've never tried it. Like, I've never been high. I've never even smoked a joint. Like, I don't do drugs. And it's like, man, like, you just seem wired differently. It's not that I have any more energy than you do. I think it's the perspective. We just came from Hawaii. We went on this tour with the historian, and he was telling us in Hawaii, they have a saying. He goes, in America, you say, like, oh, is the glass half full or half empty? Right? What would you say if I ask you, Antonio, is the glass half full or half empty?
I guess it depends on the mood, but I often feel like it's half empty.
Okay. It's half empty. So in Hawaii, the glass is always completely full. And you say, why? Because you must have air or negative space in order to have the liquid. Think about it. I know that sounds ridiculous. But the more I thought about it, it's like if you fill a glass all the way to the rim, you can't drink it without spilling it. You need some of the emptiness. So what they're saying is even when the glass is half empty, right, is what you said, it's still full because that air is needed. Come on, Antonio. You got to feel that thought.
So you're saying it's 100% full. It's 50% full of water, 50% full of air.
That's you being literal. I'm saying the glass is always full.
Because even the negative space is required, you're saying.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If you go to the refrigerator and you fill it up with juice, how you fill it up to where? You don't fill it to the rim. Right? You need a little bit of air. Right?
Yeah.
Why? Because that air is needed. So that's this Hawaiian thought process is always full. Like you need everything that's in that cup. You need it. It's a positive perspective no matter how you look at it. I get it. There are going to be downtimes there, but I can also say, like, the downtimes that I had, when I look back, they were so necessary. You know what I mean? Like, you just have to look at things like that, man. And I look at being a dad, it's just, it's so impressive. You have people that look up to you, people who are looking to you for guidance, for protection. You know what I mean? So everything that you do, I curse a lot. I'm working on it. But Miles was at school, a bug, I guess, came in through a window. And Miles said, that damn bug. That's a reflection of me. Like, I got to work on that.
The other day, Javier's really into music, and he was trying to get his mic stand to adjust just the way he wanted it. And something happened. The mic fell out. And, you know, he's in the other room, and I hear him, and he goes, God damn it. You know, and like, that's not a little kid swear. Like, not when you say it.
Right.
With that emphasis, you know, that like,
at four, he's four.
Yeah, that's
right?
exactly me.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, of course.
And then he said it to himself, you know, as he picked the mic up, and no one else is in the room with him. He just like let it out, and I was like, oh no, what have I done?
I know.
Does being a designer and an artist and an influencer make you a better or worse dad?
I think design is just a form of expression. So I think if you're a great designer or even a really good designer, you're simply good at expressing yourself. You're simply good at storytelling. And I think the better storyteller you are, the better father you can be. To be a good storyteller, it is understanding your audience. It is understanding your message. And then it is having a specific vehicle to tell that story. I can tell the same story to four different groups, and I'm going to tailor it to get the biggest laugh or the biggest reaction to that particular audience, right? And I think that awareness is great for being a dad. And I think too often we talk at our kids and not with our kids. When you're talking at them, they'll listen. They may even abide by it. But I think when you talk with them, you're listening, you're giving them time to speak and understanding like their perspective, you start to understand that they know a lot more than you think they know. Elle is way smarter than me at 7. I mean, way beyond, right? So I picked them up from school and I said, like, hey, do you guys want ice cream? They're like, yeah. So I take them, Chick-fil-A, they get cone. Elle gets a cup with a lot of fruit. And then I go to Smoothie King. And she's like, no fair. You didn't say you were getting a smoothie. I was like, well, I asked you, did you want ice cream? You said yes. So I get my smoothie and I pull off. She's like, can I just have some, like two sips? I was like, no, you have ice cream and fruit. And she goes, what I don't understand is that every day of our lives, you're teaching us about caring for people and sharing. And then your daughter asks you for a healthier option, a smoothie with protein in it, and you say no. I had no rebuttal. Like, I sat there and I was like, damn it. So I turned around and I just got her smoothie. That is stretch. Like, that's the whole meaning of stretch.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Dadwell podcast. If you were inspired by what you heard, please take a few minutes to write a review on iTunes. As a new podcast, this helps a ton and would mean a lot to me. Dadwell is on Twitter, Instagram, Medium, and all the other relevant social networks. So visit dadwell.co to find links to all of those. While you're there, you can also subscribe to the Dadwell newsletter, check out some helpful resources and books, and even cop some fresh Dadwell merchandise. Additionally, you can support this project by becoming a patron via patreon.com/dadwell. That's patreon.com/dadwell. Thanks so much for listening. My name is Antonio Garcia, and we'll talk again soon. Cheers.